And I'll tell you that again. Did I lie to you at the beginning of the semester when I told you that it's a lot of work at the beginning of the semester and that it sort of tails off?
Well, that's not true.
But now you're doing it to yourself, right? I was doing it to you at the beginning, and now you're doing it to yourself.
It's a different type of work.
I much more enjoy working on it now than I did before.
Okay. So let's see. The focus of tonight's class, you can think of how people and computing become engaged in three different ways. You can think of the computer is sitting in front of the person. The person will use the computer. So I have a computer running at computer speed, and it's doing computer kinds of things. I got a person running at person speed, doing person kinds of things, and they got to figure out how to interact. That's human-computer interaction. Okay? The second thing is, I might have a bunch of people here and a bunch of people someplace else, and we might want to use the computer to support our interaction at a distance. Or a bunch of people here, and we might want to use the computer to support our interaction locally. Or we might want to support our interaction across time between people, either locally or remotely. And that's computer-mediated communication. All right? So, in one case, I've got people using the computer, and there's one person and one computer. The other case, I've got people using other people. No. Somehow interacting with other people, and I've got the computer is just kind of incidental to this. Right? We provide the capabilities that the people need. But here, we're going to have the reversed situation. We're going to have now the computing is the thing we're talking about. We're talking about the social control of computing. So you've got your computer. You've got your computer. How do you all get along in the world without your computer bothering her computer? Right? So we have some social organization that says you're not allowed to conduct a denial of service attack. You can't send her a virus. If you send something to someone else, she can't see it because you want your privacy maintained. Right? So we have computing that's going to go on for whatever reason. And because there are people involved in this process, we're going to have a social process of regulating the way in which this computing occurs. Right? So we're not actually focused on the people here. We're not focused on the interaction between the people and the computers. But we're focused on how the computing process is regulated. Now, that's not necessarily what you would have chosen as a cover story if I were going to tell you about viruses. I mean, sometimes we ought to talk about viruses. We don't really talk much about them. But viruses are something one person does to another person's computer. They deny that person the ability to use their computer in the way they want it to do. So I can cast viruses in this. I can cast encryption in this. I've got this overlay, which is not the main point. And then I've got all of these details, which are the main point. So here's how the story is going to evolve. In every case, I'm going to have some kind of objective, right? And we'll cast those objectives in a social context. So I'll say that in the context of computing, I want to have some concept of identity because some people are authorized to do certain things. For example, I might be authorized to see your files on these computers so that I can grade assignments you store on the computers. Remember at the midterm, we had that authorization that we had to turn on for you, right? So that depends upon my identity. When Yi Ju was teaching for me, when I was out of town, he had to get authorized as an instructor in the teaching theaters, right? So all of that depends upon us knowing the identity. Now, if one of you were to impersonate me somehow, then you would be making some kind of an attack on the concept of identity that we had socially constructed, this role of instructor. Does that make sense? So we're going to think about the things that we wish our computing services to provide. And then we're going to think about what technology can I use. Well, first we're going to think about what threats exist. What non-computing threats, like if you have a password and you keep it in your wallet, I can steal your wallet, right? So I don't need a computing threat to attack your computational model of identity, right? Just as if you have a credit card, I can steal your credit card number without actually taking your credit card. So we're going to think about what kinds of threats exist to ownership, to identity, to privacy, and to integrity. And then we're going to think about what kind of defenses exist. And just as we have two kinds of threats, non-technical threats and technical threats, we'll have two kinds of defenses. We'll have technical defenses. For example, you might have really good passwords that you can never remember they're so good. Right? So you have to write them down and put them in your wallet, which of course creates one of those vulnerabilities. So we might have non-technical or technical threats, and then we might have non-technical threats. And technical defenses and non-technical defenses. Okay, and along the way, we'll encounter many of the things that you will be able to use in conjunction with what you already know. So for example, I'm going to protect your passwords while you're logging in, which means while your password is moving through the network, no one on the network can see it. So somehow your password is known to you because you typed it in. It's known to the computer on the other end. But it isn't known to the router that's routing your password. It's actually sending your password from here to there without knowing what it is. If I don't protect it that way, then if I want to know your password, all I have to do is pay for the router. In fact, what I do is I just put a little program inside the router that takes every packet and routes it where it's supposed to go, and to me. And then I'll have everything that goes across the network, and then I just build something called a password sniffer, and I've got your password. So we need a technical defense against that particular attack. And that technical defense turns out to be the secure shell, SSH. And so but that SSH turns out to be useful all over the place. Okay, so if we think about what kind of access we want to provide, we can think about it in lots of different ways. So, for example, we can think about who's entitled to have computing facilities. Now, these are not technical questions. These are social questions. For example, can only well-to-do people have broadband access, or should broadband access be priced at a level that is available to all members of our society? And if you bought the second one of those, what concept of our society did you have in mind? Were you thinking of all the people in Maryland, all the people in the United States, all the people in the Northern Hemisphere, all the people in the world? Probably you weren't thinking of all the people in the world if you were thinking that we were going to price broadband at a point where everybody could afford it. Right? So we've got fundamental questions of who gets the hardware, who gets certain kinds of software. So maybe I make an operating system, so this is true of Windows, that has a large fraction of the market. Should I be allowed to hold that much of the market? Or should competitors like Linux be encouraged so that we can build things like one laptop per child, where the operating system costs more than the laptop if you try to put a Microsoft operating system on it, right? Or should we impose price controls and tell Microsoft what they're allowed to charge for certain kinds of software? And if we do, what kinds of limitations will then emerge in the capabilities that Microsoft would be financially incentivized to provide? Would they keep their software updated? Would they release new versions? Okay, so there are all sorts of equity issues that revolve just around computing facilities. Now, when you think about the network, you get the same kinds of issues for the network. So, for example, for technical reasons, in the United States, providing broadband access in rural areas is far more expensive than providing broadband access in urban areas, because the cheapest technology, the telephone modem called ADSL, the asymmetric digital router line, will only go a certain distance. In fact, it won't go from the central office near College Park to my house. I can't get ADSL in my house, right, because it's more than 3 miles or something from the central office. So in rural areas where people are 30 miles from the phone company's central office, you have to employ more expensive technologies. Who should pay for that technology? Should that technology be paid by charging a tax to everyone? Should that technology be paid for by charging everyone the same price for broadband service, regardless of whether it's more expensive to provide them that service? That's what was done with the phone company. That's what's done with the post office, right? It's very, the post office makes a lot of money moving first class mail between major cities, because that's a low cost operation that they do in high volume. They lose a lot of money providing delivery to every single address in the United States that's a rural address. Right, that's very expensive. So there's a cross-subsidy that's set up, and it's set up in the structure of the market. So the post office is given a monopoly in exchange for providing that cross-subsidy. Right? And the phone company was, at one point in this country, given a monopoly in exchange for providing that cross-subsidy. Airlines, the same, were at one time given that. Okay, so we've got all of these issues with networks, and then, of course, libraries are one of the, public libraries, are one of the types of access points for people who would not otherwise have access to the network, both wireless access in libraries, for people who have their own computers, and computers that you can sign up for. So there's these questions of, what's the mission of the library? How much space does the library give over to this? How much money does the library spend on this? Where do these things come from? So there are things like E-rate that cross-subsidizes the cost of putting your library on the network, buys you bandwidth, essentially. Okay, so, and then if I'm giving you money as the federal government for E-rate, can I tell you that you must install filters? Because we as the federal government have decided that our money will not be given to people who don't install filters. So I can't, as the federal government, tell you to install filters, maybe. In fact, according to the Supreme Court, I can't. But I can tell you I won't give you my money if you don't. And I can tell you that I'm going to take the money away from you. I'm going to make you legally give it to me. And I'll put you in jail if you don't give it to me. And then I will give you the money and let you do what I want. So at what point has the federal government exceeded the scope of the Commerce Clause? Right. So we get into all of these issues because we use them, the cross-subsidy, to enforce other social goals. Okay, and so the question, how do all those things get adjudicated? Then we can start to look at who can own information. So if I, as an author, write a journal article and I sign over the copyright to a publisher, and the publisher makes the journal article available for a fee, can I also make the journal article available on my website? What's that? No. That's actually not the right answer.
Depends
on my contract with the publisher. So the publisher could give me the right to do that. So we've set up this entire body of law to regulate these things. And then we set up this body of contracts that alter the other what would otherwise be the effect of the body of law. So the copyright devolves to me, not to the publisher, but then my contract, I transfer the copyright to the publisher. As an inducement to do it, the publisher gives me certain rights, and we have to keep these rights in balance if we're going to have a publisher that has a reasonable business model, authors who are reasonably incentivized, and content that is reasonably available to people. And if we were to establish such a delicate balance, how would that balance then be disrupted if instead of copies costing 5 or 10 cents a page, they cost 0 cents per page? Instead of them being not as high quality as the original, they were identical to the original. Well, you would expect that some adjustments in the delicate balance would be needed. But then when the adjustments are made, what process is used to bring forward the arguments, and how does the power structure line up in such a way that Mickey Mouse gets protected appropriately, right? So you get all the copyright law stuff shows up. So we've got the facilities, the network, the content, right? And then this is the one where people, I think, engage in fuzzy thinking. If you talk about the digital divide, which is now a bit of a passé term, right, but it was a very evocative term a few years ago, where it was the haves and the have-nots, it was easy to get people to agree that there were social goods to be achieved by having broader access to information. Right? And so you could get everybody to agree on that. And then you could have a discussion about cost-benefit ratios, who should have control, should I be able to influence what you can see if I'm paying for it. All of those discussions come to the fore. Those all live up here. But as I hope you've come to realize by now, and if you haven't, you'll have it in the next couple of years, you are an elite. You are a group of people who are better able to make use of this wealth of information than almost anyone on the planet. And that's what we're creating. We're creating an information elite because you have skills. So the real digital divide, after I get done taking care of all those other more amenable issues to the best of my ability, the real digital divide is in who's sitting in this classroom. Right? The people sitting in this classroom are much, much better prepared. The people who are going through high school in the first world are much, much better prepared than people in the third world, even if I give them a computer, even if I put translation software on them that gives them access to the information. Right? And so how do you give people the tools they need for how to find things? I mean, one of the great successes of web search engines, which is almost invisible, is that if you asked a decade ago how well can the average undergraduate search for things themselves, you would have come up with not very well. Why? Well, nobody's ever shown them how to do it. They don't have any experience doing it. Now, if you talk to somebody who teaches undergraduates, they will complain vociferously that the undergraduates don't think, they just Google it. Well, I mean, okay, maybe that's a problem, but that's a better problem to have than the undergraduate not being able to think and not being able to Google it, which was the case 10 years ago. Right? You didn't have this broad understanding of search strategies. Not search strategies taught, but search strategies acquired through experience. And so there are people who study how do people gain these search strategies outside of educational settings, and how do we transfer these? How does this kind of innovation diffuse through the society? And the same thing happens with information use. So it's very common now to teach high school students how to assess the quality of information. It's something we spend a good deal of time on. But we teach in high schools how to do this because there's so much really bad information that's available, which wasn't the case before. Right? There wasn't, I mean, we used to live in a world of information shortage. We now live in a world of information abundance. And so you need to teach different sets of skills. So the question is, who teaches these things? How do they get access? And if I put a one child per laptop computer in front of somebody who's never seen a computer, how do they think of it in a way that's different from a doorstop? I mean, what's their mental model there? So what do I do that causes it, when you first look at it, to suggest to you how you should behave with respect to it? I mean, baseballs are much better than computers at suggesting to you what you should do with them. Right? Okay, so all of these equity issues draw the broad panoply of what we're talking about today. And then we're going to go looking specifically at a set of them that come around the management of these four issues here: ownership, identity, privacy, and integrity. Okay, so who has a right to use this computer? Nobody's using it right now, but who has the right to use that computer?
Like,
technically, anybody who can get into this building and has rights to the classroom can use that computer. Really?
Somebody has to provide access to the room to use that specific computer.
Okay, so they have to have access to the room, and they have to have an account on the system. But someone who I could think there are a whole group of people who don't have access to the room at this time.
Right.
Because there's a class going on. So it wouldn't be proper for them to come in. They don't have the right to use this. Right. Who paid for that computer? What's that?
Your tuition money?
The state of Maryland, maybe the federal government, maybe alumni, the university. Who decided who has the right to use the computer?
The administration.
Not the people who paid for it. Right. So there's some process by which someone has been legitimated to establish a process, or to establish the access rights for that computer. It's not necessarily related to the ownership of the computer, or who paid for it, but it is related to the ownership of the access rights. Now, I'm going to actually claim I have the right to use this computer from home. That specific computer. So you might have been thinking when I was asking the question originally, who has the right to sit in front of the computer and type on the keyboard? But I can use this computer, at least the computer this is connected to, which is actually in the back room, I can use that computer remotely. Who has the right to use that computer remotely?
Who has a password system in this
computer? Oh, but I don't have a password for that computer for remote access.
Then you hacked
it. No, I just pinged it. I simply sent it a message to which it responded. So I used it. I caused it to do something. That's what it means to use a computer, right? I decided I wished that it do something. I issued a command, and it did it. So the university has decided that that computer will respond to ping. That PING from the command line space and its IP address, and it will come back and respond to me 5 times. You all have done this several times, right? I asked you to ping the computers for homework, right? That belong to other people. You didn't think that you were doing anything inappropriate, did you? They made the computer available for ping. They didn't have to. They could have put it behind a firewall that blocked pings, but they didn't. So, you have the right to ping your computer, is that right? I have the right to ping that computer from home, right? Okay. How many times can I ping that computer from home? Can I ping it a lot? So much that the person sitting in front of it notices that it slows down? That would start to get near this denial of service attack threshold, right? Depending on, if I just made it slow down for a moment, slightly, in its computation of SETI at home or something, whatever it does when it's otherwise busy, that probably wouldn't be denial of service. But if I sit here intending to bring it down, that would be denial of service. What if I turn something loose that pings that computer, but it doesn't, I didn't intend to deny service to somebody using it, it just had that effect. It wasn't my intent. Do I have the right to do that? Or is it my obligation not to design software that will have that effect? What's being regulated here? What's owned? Before we try to enforce our ownership, what is actually owned? Where is this line? Do I have to have intent?
Why do you have to have intent if somebody says to you,
like,
you're
going on
my computer stuff, and then you say, oh, I didn't know that, okay, sure.
But how would I communicate with them? Are they just sitting here pinging me? I can't send them an email. All I've got is their IP address. I don't know who they are.
Can you ping them?
I can ping them back and on their computer. This doesn't really actually sound like a good social regulation process, but...
But if you did contact them and you asked them to cease and desist and they said, oh, sure, we didn't know that what the result was. And so then, as a result of them contacting
you... You're saying that would seem reasonable to you?
Yeah.
Is there a law on this? Is it illegal for me to engage in a denial of service attack against that computer inadvertently? It's legal if it's inadvertent.
Yeah, how do you prove it's inadvertent? Well, if you break the law.
Like,
isn't it like you...
Oh, so murder, it doesn't matter whether my murder was intentional or accidental.
Well,
actually,
it doesn't matter. But, you know... I'm a robber,
no?
But if you weren't intending to feed and you got pulled over saying, I didn't realize I was feeding, you still get a ticket.
Okay. So we'd like to have a way that causes that not to be appropriate, that regulates that. So there are 2 ways we can regulate it. One is, we can go through this discussion, go to the state legislature, get them to pass a law. There actually is a law on this. Right? The Maryland state law. So we get them to pass a law, that the law requires it to be intentional. And then we can call Sherlock Holmes, figure out who it is that's run the denial of service attack against us, and put them in jail. Yes? Except it might cost more to hire Sherlock Holmes than we would benefit from having them stop bothering our computer. So, let me give you another example. What if I make a program that you can download for free on the internet? And this program will draw pretty pictures on your screen while it erases your birthday. It's called a virus, right? So it appears to be doing something for you, but it does something you don't like also. Is my action legal?
somewhere when you download it that's going to erase your hard drive? If it's not, then that would be stateful.
Right. Stated that it's not going to erase your hard drive.
No. Nothing stated about it. So my action is illegal, right? Because laws have been passed about maliciously damaging other people's computers. So all this ownership stuff has to be adjudicated, right? And so my making the virus is illegal. You can send me to jail for that. But we don't rely on finding people who make viruses and sending them to jail as our only way of preventing there from being problems, because there are simply more 16-year-old kids in the world who know how to program than there are cops. Right? And the first time a 16-year-old kid learns how to program a virus, it seemed really cool. So they do it, and if you threw them all in jail, eventually you wouldn't have any computer programmers left, because that's where they come from. Right? So there's a limit to what you can achieve by throwing people in jail, right? So that's the case where we then go in and impose technical means. So in that case, because the law isn't able to completely solve the problem, we use the law for the cases that are particularly egregious. And in the meantime, we say to you, how many times have you said this to yourself? Damn, I really gotta get a virus checker in my next computer because this one just got screwed up by a virus. Happened to anybody in here? No? Okay. Who did you feel made the wrong decision? You, right? You're the one that didn't get the virus checker. Now that's a little weird, right? Didn't we just transfer to the person who bought the computer, that owns the computer, the responsibility to prevent other people from doing something bad? But that's the same thing you do when you put a lock on your house, right? I mean, why did you put a lock on your house? You're bearing the expense of installing the lock so people won't steal stuff. But it's illegal to steal stuff. It's just awfully inconvenient if somebody actually does steal something. So it's handy to have a lock as sort of a first line of defense. So it's very common for us to have this balance between a legal protection that is a pretty heavy hammer, and you only pull it out in cases where it's actually cost-effective to do it, either for its direct benefit, stop somebody from doing something really awful, or for its deterrent benefit. You put enough 15-year-old kids in jail, then the 15-year-old kids will get the idea, right, and not do that. So, but then we use technical means of protection, and we transfer to you the responsibility, and if you don't lock your car doors and somebody steals something from your car, you're quite likely to think, oh, I gotta remember to lock my doors in the future. Stupid me, because people stealing things from your car seems like an act of nature. Okay, so if we're gonna do the legal side, we get all these questions of who has the right, who establishes the policy, how do they do it, and how do we balance the rights that need to be protected. The viruses are an example of a denial of service attack. Another example of a denial of service attack was the multiple pinging. Another example of a denial of service attack is what's called a distributed denial of service. So here's what I do with a distributed denial of service. I send you a program that doesn't hurt your computer at all. It hurts somebody else's computer. Okay. What's that? So the thing I send you is a zombie program that, when I activate it, will bring down someone else's. So I want to bring that computer down. I don't want you to be able to trace it back to me. So I send a zombie program to you, and then at the right time, I activate the zombie program, and you make a denial of service attack against that, despite the fact that you don't know how to program a computer. So you couldn't have created the attack. So now I'm in some sense insulated, because Sherlock Holmes has a very hard time figuring out that I'm the one that did it. It's just a bunch of ones and zeros. Came from someplace. Now, you would think that would be complex enough, right? We started out with denial of service attacks, and now we get distributed denial of service attacks. But the ability to control zombie programs actually has economic value. I could be in the business of making zombie programs and getting them disseminated around the network, and then I could sell the access to the zombie programs. You know, they all passwords on them or something, a list of the machines they're downloaded to, and then I could sell those to people who actually want to do denial of service attacks. What's that? Well, of course it's illegal. Well, it's not just fun, it's money-making, it's profitable, right? So now, if you want to attack this, you have to attack it financially. You have to look at who's paying the money to someone else. So now you get these distributed denial of service attacks that can bring an enormous amount of activity on a focused part of the network. And you're saying, isn't that illegal? Now you're imagining, I think, that there's a body that can make the law, right? Which is fine, as long as we're in this classroom, because we would have to follow not just the law, but the rules of the University of Maryland. Or maybe if we were in the state of Maryland, it might be made illegal by the state of Maryland. But now, what if the state of Maryland makes it illegal, and the response, or the attack comes from the District of Columbia? Now, what if the person that sold the zombies, installed the zombies that are illegal in Maryland, what if that person was in the District of Columbia and then somebody from Virginia bought the access to the zombies? Yeah?
But aren't they attacking servers in Maryland?
Yes.
So there isn't some sort of jurisdiction there?
So you're saying that Maryland could claim jurisdiction and the federal government could not preempt because this does not involve interstate commerce. Oh, well, maybe it does involve interstate commerce, so perhaps a federal law is what we need. If we had a federal law that made it illegal to do this, which we do,
then only Canada
could attack us. And indeed, this happens. So let's say that I wanted to have a war with Liechtenstein. Is that the one with the mouse that roared? Okay, so I want to go to war with Liechtenstein, right? And Liechtenstein wants to go to war with me, right? Because you know why in the mouse that roared Liechtenstein wanted to go to war with the United States? Was that? No, so they could get foreign aid to rebuild their country, right? So, in any case, let's say Liechtenstein and we both want to have a war for whatever reason. We have some domestic reason for it, they have some domestic reason for it, so we're going to have a war. Now in the old days, what you would do is you would get a tank and drive it to Liechtenstein, and then we'd get an airplane and fly it to New York, you know, and you would threaten bodily harm. But these days, if I were Liechtenstein and I wanted to attack the United States, all I would have to do is bring down all the servers on Wall Street. And those cost a phenomenal amount of money, and the United States would say, we give up. Right? We don't want to fight Liechtenstein anymore. They're too good for us. Right? So this actually happens now. Countries that are wishing to express their displeasure with what other countries have done, will attack their financial networks. There have been several cases of this. You must know of other cases of this where, you know, somebody puts up something on their website and somebody has different political views and so they replace it with Playboy photos or something, right? And that's enough to make the news, which embarrasses the people for not having good information security. Right. So there are all sorts of sort of variants of this at different levels. But if I put Playboy photos on your website, I am the United States, I'm a citizen of the United States, you're in the United States, you could probably take me to court. But what do you do in Liechtenstein?
Speaking of the
UN,
but...
And what would you say to them? You would say, would you please issue a resolution or something? I mean, this isn't working too well with Israel and the Palestinians. You know, so we're going to... These people attacked by Masjid? Yeah, okay. So, you have two choices. Three choices. You can either live. Get a better virus protector, put a firewall in, or whatever. Just, you know, say, okay, fine. We'll just make it so hard that you'll stop wasting time on this. Or, you can consider it to be an act of war. That's how countries ultimately work these things out. There are no cops to call, right? They're playing the music too loud at night, and you don't like it. What do? You deliver it, or you invade it. Okay. So, or... You can get an international treaty that countries have to enforce by their domestic law, and you can get every country in the world to agree to it, or enough that it becomes customary international law. Now, which of these things do you think is the most practical? What's that? Labor they can come up with some technical means of defense, right? Okay, so we're driven to technical means of defense against these attacks for two reasons. One is, the law is a blunt instrument. The other is, they didn't call it the World Wide Web for nothing, right? It exceeds the jurisdiction of any jurisdiction on the planet. And as a result, there are some things you simply cannot legally enforce. Because you have to get other people to agree. For example, let's say that we had a moral belief that everybody should be able to see anything, any information they wanted. Now, that's a bit of an overstatement, but it's pretty close to what the American Library Association believes. I mean, you should have really good reasons, maybe a national security or something. But even then, we could have a little debate about whether, you know, something that the government claims is secret should be secret, right? So, you should have some really good reasons to keep people from looking at stuff. Unless, of course, you live in China. There's a good one. How do we actually prevent people from seeing information? Well, we just put a little roadblock in the internet, right? The people who build routers, they just build into their router that if it's this kind of information, you know, if it has like a 30 word in it or something, then just don't send it. So, you know, all these programs are pretty good at handling dropped packets because networks aren't too terribly reliable. Well, let's just find every packet with a dirty word in it and we'll drop the packet and let them worry about it on the other end. Right. So national firewall. That stuff's not coming into China. That's legal. Of course it's legal. I mean, China makes laws about China. I mean, right might be different from legal, but you can't debate whether or not it's legal. If China makes it legal, it's legal. Yes? Where's the router built? No. Silicon Valley. In the United States of America. And here's the question. Is it legal to sell the router to China? I mean, would that be, can the United States prevent routers from being sold to China? American routers, those made in Silicon Valley.
Well, it's a
okay, so can we? You're arguing shouldn't. Can the United States pass a law that says that we cannot send to China, an American company cannot send to China a router
can, but it won't happen.
But that?
You can, yes, but it won't happen.
Oh, no, we actually do this. Not with routers to China. But, for example, with encryption technology, we'll talk about encryption technology tonight. We have laws that prevent you from sending North Koreans encryption technology.
But that's
different than routers?
Well, security.
Routers aren't?
But the reason why we're not telling you would not want to sell the routers to China would be a moral issue, not a security issue.
So you're saying that security has a higher moral standing than other moral issues?
Well, I can see
it. Are you being made? Okay, so you might decide not to do, so we certainly could pass a law on this, and we do pass laws on similar things, and you're saying that this might not meet your threshold for passing a law.
Remember the packet snippers that I told you about? If we didn't send routers to China, who do you think would?
Our enemies.
Maybe even our friends. Usually the French. What's that? Or maybe they could produce it themselves. Maybe we would encourage them to create a local market for routers. Now, who would you rather have sending your routers to China? People in Silicon Valley, where you could send them a router that would send like all the packets back to the U.S. for free, or people in China, who would probably design their routers as well, or people in France, who would get all the packets sent back to France.
That's a lot of routers, a lot of money.
Or, yes, a lot of routers, a lot of money. Okay, so there are all kinds of issues around which things you want to control. Where do you want to put in the control, right? And so we have American companies that are indeed selling routers to China. And the Chinese are using them to control the information that their population can see, because that's what routers do. They control the dissemination of the information. Okay. So, we talked about national security being a basis for preventing the dissemination of information. Would everybody agree that not everything is claimed to be national security, but that there are some things that are national security that we should not allow people to see? We might have some difficulty agreeing on which things they are, but there should be some things in that category. How about companies? Would you allow companies the same degree of protection? So if a company had a trade secret, some process for making Coca-Cola, would you allow them to protect it to the same degree that you would, or to nearly the same degree, you know, where you would throw people in jail for this, or sanction them in some serious way? You have social sanctions. The society would sanction inappropriate behavior that way. Okay, so we'd agree that there's something that will allow companies to do. There's something that will allow in the interest of national security. Right. We'd all be comfortable with there being something in that sense. How about parents? Would we all agree that there are some things that parents should be able to prevent children from seeing? Mm-hmm. Regardless of whether we could agree with other parents on what those things should be. Some parents would want to like keep their kids from knowing about how to make bombs or something. Others would worry about other things. I don't think it was okay to get some bombs. Okay, so we're going to have some kind of parental control, some kind of intellectual property protection, some kind of spirit protection. That means we're going to need some way of making these difficult decisions about which things are subject to these constraints. Now, what's the difference between those things and censorship? This was the Chinese blocking things on the internet, right?
I feel like censorship is most of these, the first three are, I am stopping you from saying this for my own protection,
and censorship is, I am stopping you from pursuing this, for your.
Really? So you think that parental control, for example?
Well, there are legal ramifications for a parent who do not take care of their child. So if the child learns to makes a bomb, the parent gets in trouble.
Well, that seemed convoluted to me when you said it. Might not really have been convoluted, but you were saying, well, socially we've agreed we'll hold the parents responsible for certain things, although it's a little hard to know which of them we'll hold the parents responsible for. So we have to give the parents the ability to do this because they're acting in their own interest, not in the interest of their child. I don't think most parents probably see it that way.
Probably
not. I think the choices the parents are making are probably motivated by the good of the child, in their opinion.
And in that case, you could probably carry on with Chinese censorship.
I see. So parental control is censorship.
It's always going to be aligned with it.
It's all censorship.
It's all socially defined.
No, I don't have missile codes, and that's not.
You're not kidding. You really, keeping you from knowing missile codes is not censorship.
I don't think so. I think there's experience so separate from censorship. I really do. And it's not because I work for the federal government.
So, Ronald Reagan is quoted as having said that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom. Right? And so there's these are very loaded terms that we use. And the technology for implementing censorship is very similar to the technology for implementing all these other protections. Hard to tell apart. The social structures built to achieve censorship, very hard to tell apart from the social structures built for these other purposes. To a large degree, censorship is the way in which we socially construct the label of bad, and these other labels are labels that we have socially constructed as good. But the technology itself isn't very different. So, for example, let's say that I wish to support parental control. Well, then maybe I'll buy some software that will replay for me whatever it is my kids did on the computer. Right? People do that, right? You get this net nanny or something like that, and you can just sit down and hit play, and you can see a fast-forward version of whatever it is your kid did on the computer. I could do the same thing for national security, right? I could, in an office, put net nanny in so that I could come by and see if you've been looking at pornography or something. In fact, that's what people use to see if you've been looking at pornography. It's a net nanny-like thing that at the internet, the main internet router, right? It knows where it's going in the company, and it knows where it's going out. They don't have to stick it on your machine, but they can reconstruct what you saw on your machine. And surely people who are worried about national security have got one of these things, not looking for pornography, but looking for classified material that's moving through email systems, for example. If I have an unclassified email, a classified email, I can certainly read the classified email, type something into the unclassified email that's classified, and I want to find that, or I want to see that happen. So exactly the same kinds of controls that we have here, and of course we can use similar things here, right? So that I can see if people are, for example, talking on blogs about subjects which I wish they wouldn't, and if they do, I can arrest them and put them in jail. Which is exactly what I would do if they were sending email about national security. I would see that they have done this and arrest them and put them in jail. And so we're doing the same thing here as we're doing there. You're not fine. Because?
I think you can blog about your opinion on anything.
You can?
Yeah. Go ahead for it. Go nuts. Have fun.
Yes.
I think you should not be able to post missile codes.
Well, certainly you can post missile codes as long as they're badly out of date.
Yeah, go for it. And you can blog. You can have opinions on them and you can blog them.
Okay.
But isn't the only difference that you think one's good and the other's bad? I mean...
I think one of them can kill all of us, and your opinion cannot.
Whether you're logging on corporate time or corporate computer, or if you send me the email through your corporate email, that's separate from if you were doing it.
Oh, but if I'm blogging about what's going on inside my company, I can be fired for that, can't I? I mean, I can't be thrown in jail for it. Oh, I can certainly be fired for it if my company doesn't like the fact that I've been giving out trade secrets or influencing the stock market by saying things in advance of announcements that violate FCC rules. I mean, I don't disagree that there are vastly different scale of consequences. But on other dimensions, it's very hard to tell the difference here. And we could have a debate about the scale of the consequences. I mean, if I were the Chinese government and I were worried about a nuclear power being destabilized and had 1.3 billion people, I might make a national security argument to censor them. In Germany, you can't talk about Nazism.
No, you can't.
What's that?
You can't deny the Holocaust happened.
Right.
So that's
the biggest issue. And you can't claim to be a doctor if you have a PhD unless it's from a German university. They put people in jail for these things. So there are things that in some countries would seem to us to be
preposterous.
And yet, there are things we do. The Germans look at us and they're like, oh, surely you can't be serious. I mean, there was something a few years ago about you couldn't make up cartoons that involved underage people having sex. You know, this was some sort of child pornography. But the child pornography laws were originally created to keep underage people from being exploited. And there were very few underage people who knew how to make the cartoons. I mean, they were being made by people who were of an age of majority, who were creating art. I mean, maybe lousy art. Maybe art that doesn't have a very good social purpose. But, you know, no kids were harmed during the production of this, you know, funny-looking cartoon. And yet there were people trying to make it illegal, and the Germans are just sitting here laughing. What the hell are you doing? This is silly. So, but what makes us right and what makes the Germans wrong, or vice versa? It's just that the net is a messy place to try to adjudicate all that. Okay. So we've decided that sometimes we're going to let some people limit use by some process of deciding what should be limited, right? Whatever the heck that is. So now, finally, the geeks come into play, and we get to actually force them to behave our way. So what do we do? Well, I can create access controls on my computer. That one very easy way of establishing ownership, I can just create passwords. Right? Make you run the password, not give you the password if you're not authorized. I have some social structure for deciding who's authorized to get passwords. Maybe I bought a computer, it's mine. I can see everything on it. You can't see anything on it because it's mine. We kind of feel this way about our laptops, right? You always feel a little squeezy when you give somebody your laptop, even if there's a good reason for doing it. So we have access controls. In corporate environments, we'd like to be able to give some people access to some of the information. So for example, at one point I worked in the Office of Naval Research, and I was a reservist, so I wasn't there full time. And I could see certain kinds of things related to the projects I was working on. I couldn't see pay records of people. I couldn't see grant decisions that involved the university that I happened to work at. So there were things that I could see and things that I couldn't see. Right? You have this with your projects, right? You have a space where you share with each other, at least some of you from this information I sent out, in your RAM pages, you gave access to certain people who could write into your directories and other people can't. Did anybody use that? Did I send it out?
Yes, you did.
I did. Okay. But nobody's using it.
Okay, okay.
I didn't get it.
I can send it again if you want it. In any case, you can give people access. Remind me, I'll send it again. You can give people access to your WAM hub space to write into, so that everybody in your team can write into the same space. And they can even erase everything inadvertently. So you might want to think about whether you do this. Okay. So, but nobody else on WAM can write into it. So that's an example of multi-level access. Some people have some rights. A problem with multi-level access is that there must be someone who set up those rights. So they had access to everything because at the very least they could give themselves access to it if they didn't initially have the access to it anymore, set up rights. They could set up rights for themselves to do whatever it was they could set up for somebody else. So there's this problem of social control over multi-level access. Right, but we have to have some social structure that prevents the insider attack. And then the second problem is that if there's a technical characteristic in my system that's not well understood, then I have to have some way of getting the some way of proving to myself that nobody can gain access to the super user's status without being authorized. So I have to prevent against the insider attack, and I also have to prevent against the unauthorized acquisition of privileges. Both of those turn out to be just enormously difficult. Socially protecting against the insider attack is impossible. Right? So the best you can do is minimize the likelihood that it will occur, and if it occurs, minimize the likelihood that it will be undetected. Right? And if it occurs, minimize the amount of damage that can be done by rapidly discovering. So you can have technical means that involve audit of rapidly finding these sorts of problems. But the second problem, the technical problem with multi-level security, is that I would have to be able to prove somehow that this computer program does not have an unintended behavior. Now that unintended behavior might be there by accident. Not intentionally. Intentionally would be bad enough. It might be there by accident. Now, the problem here is nobody knows how these computers work. These are the most complex things humans have ever created, and so no one person understands it. So there is no fully capable, provably secure operating system for computers. Every computer has uncharacterized technical risks that someone can gain inappropriate access. And so what people do when they're dealing with multi-level security in really critical applications like national security is they build parallel systems. And they move things between the parallel systems on these flash drives or by retyping. But they don't physically connect them through the network, because as soon as you physically connect them through the network, there's an opportunity for leakage that's uncontrolled. Now, just to give you a feel for how hard it is to build reliable software, who do you think spends the largest amount of money in the world on the design of operating systems?
This should be easy.
What's that? Microsoft. Microsoft spends more money on operating system development than anybody else. I mean, roughly $200 of the cost of any computer is going to Microsoft to pay for the operating system. Think of what that financial flow looks like. And that's going to buy the most reliable, secure operating system we can possibly deploy in an environment like this. How many of you subscribe to automatic updates for, you know, security critical patches? Okay. What's the average time between updates? What's that?
A week.
Yeah, okay, fine. So, hardly a week goes by when a problem that has existed for more than a week already is discovered. If you want to exploit it, all you have to do is discover the problem before the patch goes out. Well, that's exactly what happened, right? Somebody discovered the problem before the patch went out, otherwise they wouldn't have known to make the patch. So before the patch went out, the problem must have been discovered. So at what rate are problems being discovered in the operating system that's receiving the largest investment in the world? About 1 a week. That's really scary. I mean, this is not an abstract problem. You can't build reliable multi-level security because you can't prove the darn things work. And in fact, you can disprove it really easily. There's an argument, by the way, that says that all the hackers are doing a great service for Microsoft, pointing out those problems. And that all the other operating systems have just as many problems, they just don't have as many hackers. So the Microsoft operating system should be that much better because it has so many problems. It's a bit of a torture. Shall we take a break and come back in 2 minutes?
To get it mouse over.
see the picture, if the bed is smooth enough away, it stays there and lasts enough to get out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like you're over it and oh, that's kind of cool. You open up, oh, it went away. Where'd you go?
Yeah.
But
you're
not.
What would you do?
Well, I don't know. I'm going to code it.
Yeah.
It's mount over this, and then it's not.
I'm going to go to the next one.
library.
The entire course up until now has been about all the wonderful things computers can do for you. And of course, today we spend our time at the end of the semester talking about all the awful things computers can do to you. So, back when personal computers were relatively new, companies tried to come up with copy protection that would allow you to buy from them a floppy disk with software on it, but you couldn't copy the floppy disk and give it to your friends. Now, the reason they came up with this is because in the old days when companies bought software, they would have they'd sign a license, and then if the company violated the license, the company would get sued. But here we had individuals buying the license. And now if the individuals violated the license, it wasn't terribly cost-effective for the company to go out and sue all the individuals. So this created the need for technical means of protection. And so they came up with copy protections to prevent people from copying the computer programs. Now, it was a really bad idea. Or also, it was an idea well before its time, very similar to what's on DVDs now. But, so if you buy a DVD, you can't copy it very easily. In fact, you can't copy it in the United States very legally. If it has copy protection on it, which not all DVDs do,
then there is a law, a copyright law, called DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, that makes it illegal to defeat the technical means of protection. Now, the reason that law is necessary is because the technical means of protection must be defeatable, otherwise you couldn't see the movie. Right? I mean, think about it. There must be something inside the machine that decodes this and makes it look like a movie on your screen. Then you could just capture the screen and encode it again, right? So, once they put the technical means of protection there, they then need a legal overlay to make it illegal to defeat the technical means of protection. Well, back in the old days, they did this on floppy disks. Now, DVDs only last about 10 years. But floppy disks only last about 10 weeks. And so, this created a bunch of really pissed off computer owners who had bought this expensive software, which had been expensive enough to merit copy protection. So first they paid a lot of money for it, and then they had software they couldn't back up. And so as soon as the floppy disk stopped working, they had to buy it again. And this created a backlash against the companies. And the software producers eventually stopped doing this because what the people that were making upset were their best customers, the companies that were buying the software and not able to back it up. So ultimately, they shifted from copy protection to licensing. And then they only shifted back to copy protection when they could get a legal overlay built above the copy protection. So it's the DMCA that makes copy protection a feasible thing. Okay, so if you're not going to do copy protection, then you have two alternatives. One, and you have to do both of these to some extent. So one of them is you put a license in that says what you're allowed to do. Now, it used to be that if you bought a book, you could sell the book to someone else. But I can write a license that you sign that says you bought my software, but you can't sell the software to anybody else. You don't own the right to transfer. You only own the right to use it. So, people have been creating these kinds of software licenses that have very restrictive rights that essentially eviscerate copyright law. So the copyright law is a negotiated balance at a social scale, and it is trumped by the license. The license is a contract, and the contract law trumps the copyright law. The copyright law acts in the absence of a contract. Now, that's not true someplace. So, for example, in Europe, if you transfer copyright, you still retain rights that you cannot transfer, referred to in Europe as moral rights. So, for example, you have a right to the integrity of your work, whereas that right doesn't exist in the U.S. in law. Which is how we can get Richard Nixon saying, oh, I am a book. Integrity of this work, which is legal to us. Okay, now, in order to get you to sign a license, normally, if it's a contract, I would have to get you to actually sign the contract. You know, they have two copies, and you keep a copy, and I have a copy, and you imagine how big my drawer would get, right? If I were Microsoft and I had signatures from everybody I'd ever sold anything to. So instead what they did was they said, here, if you break the shrink wrap, you agree to this license. Right? This act causes that license to be agreed to. So now we have changed the social balance that would otherwise be established by copyright law, simply by the act of opening the shrink wrap. So guess where they put the license?
Inside the shrink wrap.
Right.
Okay. Well, how could you put it outside the shrink wrap if it was very big, right?
Okay. Well, these days, we transfer most of the stuff over the net. So now what you get is you get a check here for I agree. How many people here have read every license they have ever agreed to? How many of them have read the last five? So, most of us are agreeing to license terms we've never heard of before, which we will then find enforced where usually we can just apply common sense, but at some point, if there's a dispute, somebody will pull out the license that we agreed to. So, in order to avoid that problem, people have come up with well-vetted, well-understood, cookie-cutter licenses that everybody can agree to. So if I don't like copyright, and I want to have a modified version, I can have a community of people that agree to my modified version. We can call it copyleft. See, somebody did that. Right? And I can just, you know, I post on my website and says, okay, this is the copyleft website, and here's what the agreement will be. And then you just agree to the copyleft terms. Right? So there are all sorts of these things. One of the best known is the Dominion Public License. Now, in a little bit of geek humor, this is a recursive acronym. Everybody knows what acronym is, right? That's when you take the first letters of the word, you put it together, and it makes another word. So the GNU Public License has this first word, GNU. But GNU is an acronym. And it stands for GNU is not Unix. And of course, the first letter of that is G, which stands for GNU, which stands, you get the idea. Okay, so in any case, this is what geeks do in the middle of the night when they're trying to name things. So you thought copyleft was bad. Anyway, so things like the GNU Public License and Creative Commons are variants of copyright that retain certain rights. For example, in the GNU Public License, the key right that's retained is that if you modify the software that I created and am giving you the GNU Public License for, which you can have for free, you must give away the modifications. And not just the modified version executable, you must give away the source code. Otherwise, you're in violation of the license, which I can enforce. I can sue you for violating your license. So we think license, big bad, Disney, right? License, good, Richard Stallman. So the license is merely a tool for renegotiating what would otherwise be the agreement, and there is an advantage to having a group of people come together, vet the idea, consider the legal consequences, explain to people what the issues are, and then put a standard license on top of it. Okay, so you can expect to see more of this over time as companies get driven toward standardized licenses by FTC enforcement and things like that. Okay, so that's one. So now you agree to license, and the license says, let's say you agree to license that says you cannot copy this and send it to all your friends. Despite the fact that it's got no copy protection on it, you sign the license and said you will not copy it and send it to all your friends, but you may make a copy for backup. Now, what if I then say, okay, cool, but how will they ever know? I'll send it to all my friends will have it, they'll know that somebody sent it to them, but how will they know it was me? Well, the answer is, of course, I'll simply mark every copy with your name or something, right? So you get the software that says, you know, like Microsoft does this, when you first turn it on, it says, what's your name? And you, thinking, oh, what friendly software, why don't you refer to me by my name, type in your name. Or you type in someone else's name. Or the name of someone who doesn't exist. which it then cheerfully uses to say, this person who doesn't exist just edited the document, you know, all this, you know, track changes and stuff like that. Okay? So they put in social strictures that will cause you to give them your name, and then they use your name to sue you if you violate the license, because your name's in everybody's copy. Well, you're smarter than that. You'll simply change your name, and then give away the stuff, and then change your name back in your own copy, right? Okay. So, I have to have a way of putting a unique identifier into your software so that if you give it away, I keep a record of your serial number, and I pick your serial number somewhere inside the software. And the problem is you're a geek, so you know how to take the serial number back out of the software and put some other serial number in the software. Right? So I have to have a way of doing it in a way you can't remove. Fortunately, this was invented a long time ago. This is what watermarks are for in paper. Right? Not easily erased, actually comes with the paper, proves that you were the person who had this paper made. Right? So what I want to do is I want to watermark the thing I'm giving you. So let's say that I'm a professional photographer. I post my photos on the internet. I put a license on there that says you may download this for non-commercial purposes. You download it and use it for a commercial purpose. And I wish to sue you now. How do I prove that you downloaded this from my website? I have a watermark in the picture. Unfortunately, the watermarks make the picture less valuable. So, I have an invisible watermark in the picture. So you remember all of those things where JPEGs would remove all the things you couldn't see and use that for compression? So we just remove all the things you can't see and then we put back just a little bit. And we encode in the picture the watermark invisibly. That's a professor here on the campus. Was working with a company who was worried about people stealing their maps. You putting maps up on the internet is a big deal, right? What's that? So they intentionally move the contour lines by an amount that uniquely identifies each copy of the map. And then if we find the map being inappropriately used, we can read back the pattern of which map this was. You can do this with audio. So if I have a song and I want to claim that you downloaded a song and then you gave it away to all your friends, I can just watermark the song. I mean, it's earmark the song or something like that, inaudibly mark the song. I mark it in some way that when you transfer the song, you transfer the watermark along with it. There's no way that you can remove the watermark without distorting the song. Because I've encrypted it. So, watermarks then provide the basis for prosecution, and there's a second step. They're what's used to enforce the license in the strict sense. So. The pornography debate is interesting to look at. This is mostly a debate about controlling the ability of children. Because it shows you how things get adjudicated in the U.S. The web is a child of roughly 1994. So 1992, the technical standards get set. 1994, you get some of the initial content. 1996, you get search engines like Lycos. And in 1997, you get the Communications Decency Act passed by Congress that says, well, the web is going to be like a bookstore, where if you let everybody into your bookstore, you can't display Playboy out front. You have to have a back room or something like that, right? So so people are now trying to figure out how to regulate this new medium. And they're thinking in analogs from the physical, right? And the Supreme Court comes along and says, no, we had that conversation back in the physical world a long time ago, and you can't prevent adults from doing this, whether you think it's a good thing or not, you can prevent children from doing it, but you didn't say you were preventing children from doing it, you said you were preventing everybody from doing it, so you can only prevent children from doing it. So the next try, this is skipping sort of a lot of detail, was the Child Online Protection Act, which is sometime around 1998, so this is like a year later, and now they're coming out and saying, okay, you can't block everything for everybody, but only things that might be seen by children. That would be everything for everybody, wouldn't it? Because the children are pretty clever, and they can get at stuff. And so it got sent back by the Third Circuit, reviewed by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, no, you can't block it on that basis, Third Circuit, but we think it's unconstitutional, so you can probably block it on some basis, so we'll leave the block in place, but please reconsider it. Third Circuit Court reconsidered it. The federal government has again appealed this to the Supreme Court. So this is, gosh, we're going on 10 years later, still litigating whether this is legal, but its enforcement is blocked. And what this says is you cannot, if you're an internet service provider, transfer over the internet things that would be inappropriate for children to see if children might see them. Right? So this said you couldn't transfer it over the internet at all. That was taken care of pretty easily. This one is a more debatable point, and it's back and forth. So eventually Congress got sick of waiting for this to get sorted out, and they said, okay, let's not do this in an overly broad way. Let's do it a narrow way, and then let's try to have the overly broad way pared down to a size that the Supreme Court will accept. Or, you know, let's keep working on getting the broad one. But in the meantime, let's get a narrow one. So the narrow one they came up with was to say to libraries that if you took money from one of two sources, so these are essentially the Universal Service Fund for access to the network, which is E-rate, meeting a government interest in having a uniform level of service regardless of where you live, regardless of the socioeconomic status of. Or if you took funds that were allocated specifically to libraries, then you would have to block the content on machines that could be used by children in your library. But the only content you would have to block was content which was which was potentially harmful to children. Right, so obscenity is thought to be harmful to everybody, pornography is thought to be harmful to children. So you would have to block pornography. This then gets into a big debate about whether you can block pornography. And the entire argument, interestingly, turns on the question of whether you must use a technical means, or whether there exists an adequate technical means. So Child Online Protection Act says you cannot transfer it. The Children's Internet Protection Act says you can transfer it, but you must filter it if there are children involved. And so the attacks against these earlier rules depended upon the technical ability of filters. Now, you think that the operation of these filters is a little complicated. We talked about it earlier in the semester. Imagine being a Supreme Court justice, where the last thing you heard was, you know, some business dispute about some contract law. And now, you're going to do internet filters. Right? So all of a sudden, off to 690 to get up to speed on filters. So there's this enormous and consequential debate about free information access in our society
that turns on our ability to deny access to specific types of information to specific people. Therefore, you could make the argument,
without really stretching too far,
that it's censorship that is causing the information to remain available. Just as long as we can censor it for some people, certain people, to meet certain social goods, then we can make it available to other people. But if we couldn't do that, then we would have to deny its access to everyone, perhaps, or accept as a society the consequences of choking seeing this out, one or the other. But if we could filter effectively, then we could craft this middle ground in which censorship becomes a social good. This was a hard sell to AOA, for example, which was fighting hard against this and lost. And so the protections for access that exist now are that you can walk up to a librarian and request that the librarian disable the filter. That's written in the law. It's not written in the law that the librarian has to do it. Okay, so a finely balanced set of social issues to turn on our ability to deny access to information. So how do we do it? Well, the first thing to realize is every way we have of filtering is imperfect. Right, so we filter based on words. And so when we filter based on breasts, we remove breast cancer, which we shouldn't be filtering. Right? So there are words that we should be filtering out that we miss because people creatively sell things in spam to get through our spam filters, for example. And then, of course, there's the same idea. It's just not the dictionary version of the word. So there are things that we fail to get, and there are things that we get that we should have guessed. Okay, so that's going to happen no matter what we do. So essentially, there are three ways of defeating there are three ways of filtering things that you wish to have removed. One is, you can look at, now this is exactly the same technology that the Chinese are using to block access to content on the internet to adults. Right? It's just a social decision which one of these uses is good or bad. So they have exactly the same three definitions. So one is I can just look at the words. So I can make up rules like, you know, not breast, but breast cancer, okay. Right? And those won't be perfect, but I can tune those rules so that everything that should get through, but I get a lot of stuff that I wish I hadn't got. Or I can tune them so that nothing that shouldn't get through, but I miss a lot of stuff that should have got through. Right? So I've got a knob of how restrictive my rule should be. And that's going to be true for all of these. Now, that's okay as long as people are kind enough to type the stuff. But you heard earlier in the semester how easy it's getting to be to transfer audio around, but how relatively expensive it is to find out what words are spoken in the audio, and how relatively less reliable that is. So applying this technology to audio is much, much harder. Now, there actually aren't a lot of people on the internet that are simply breathing heavy and recording it for kids to listen to, right? Usually the problem is that they are shooting pictures of things, videos, and breathing heavy in the audio track, right? So there's been a lot of work done recently, which is really funny because it gets reported at all these very serious academic conferences about, you know, automatic detection of flesh tones. And, you know, you're like, is that because they're trying to find the stuff or they're trying to keep it away? But so you look at it, most of this work these days is in China. So it sort of gives you an idea that we have some interest in common on controlling access to information. Okay, so there are image-based techniques, and these are mostly based on separating out different parts of an image and then finding the replacement. Right, so
I suppose they're easy to defeat if you just wear an inch of suit or something. Okay. Now, the third way to do it is to create white lists and black lists. Black lists are sites that don't get through the filter, and white lists are sites that do get through the filter. Now, you would think that this wouldn't work very well, because if you create a blacklist and you put some site on that is that you want to block and they don't wish to be blocked, they can just change their domain name until you update your blacklist. They're good, and so spammers just update their domain name every time they send an email. Every email is from a different domain name. Has the blacklist become useless? Right? But you see something, so I don't want anything from that anymore. Well, you're never going to get anything from that anymore anyway. Why would they use that again? They know you're going to put you in the backlist. But what makes these work for filtering is that the content providers have an interest in making the filters effective. So they actually register themselves on the blacklist, saying, oh, we should not have, our content is not appropriate for minors to see, so we'll put ourselves on the blacklist, and therefore, you'll allow us to be seen by people who have credit cards. Which, after all, they weren't trying to sell to the minors who didn't have the credit cards, they're trying to sell to people who have credit cards. That's what they're trying to get your credit cards on. So there's a common interest that makes the providers of age-restricted content interested in making the blacklists work, right? And so they'll not only keep a stable domain name, but they'll actually register their domain name. One of the larger problems here is what should go on the blacklist. So if you ask parents, what should their child be able to see? Should their child be able to see pictures from a beach? Just an ordinary beach, not a nude beach. They should? Could you imagine parents with religious views that would believe that that was inappropriate? Yes, maybe. All right. So
you're assuming people are actually on the beach.
Yeah. In bikinis, perhaps. So there would be many parents who would not think that inappropriate, and some parents who might think that inappropriate. So you actually need to get different filtering sites for different preferences. Right? This is a socially constructed meaning of inappropriate. And so you ultimately need to differentiate the market. I mean, ultimately, you will probably have some parents who will feel that their children should not be able to see Republican sites. And others who feel they should be able to see Democrat sites. I mean, this is the same sort of thing that happens with spam filters, right? I've got up some mailing list, I forgot how to unsubscribe myself, so I simply declare it to be spam. And let my spam filter figure it out, right? So if I wish to keep my children from seeing certain political viewpoints, why not? So you could imagine people creating sites for all sorts of purposes. Back when we were talking about nasty things I could do to the computer, we talked about one of the things I could do to the computer is give you a virus. So the definition of a virus is to a first order, a program that attaches itself to a file. That's the analogy of a virus. Just as a virus in biology is not itself a living thing. It attaches to itself a living thing. And so it doesn't have its own independent existence. It lives inside a cell. So here a virus lives attached to a computer program. I think of it as a like those little fish on the back of the shark. The little things that are cleaning the sharks off. So So the virus is moving along, except the little fish on the back of the shark is doing the shark some good. You have some things in your stomach that are cleaning out a bunch of stuff for you, but it's doing you some good. The virus is only a virus because it's nefarious. So it's intended to do some bad. So typically it's put there without your knowledge or permission, but gosh, there are all sorts of things you install in your computer to install updates to ELL files that happen without your permission that you wouldn't really think of as a virus. So what makes most people think of something as a virus is that's something they don't want. And one of the things it can do is be a zombie, which is the thing that I don't want it to do, is become a platform from which we attack other people. So that's one of the largest uses of viruses these days. You get a lot of viruses. They're completely benign. They don't do anything harmful. Because if they did anything harmful, you get rid of them. But they're not doing anything harmful. They're just lying in wait to be used in a distributed denial of service. A rumor is a whole different piece. To get a virus on your computer, you have to move a file onto your computer somehow. And maybe not intending to. You put in a floppy disk and it's copying something off the boot block automatically, but you put something into your computer, right? So people are getting nervous about, you know, sticking USB drives, somebody else's USB drive into your computer, because people are figuring out how to transfer viruses on USB drives. They have to physically, the virus has to move to a carrier, right? There's some file to which the virus is attached. Where do we take advantage of something in the network? So I can send a virus to another computer as an email message. I'll just email it to you. So there was a little something in the email standard that when the email arrived, it would take a certain part of the email, interpret it as a computer program, and execute it. You know, it was supposed to like be a little flashing icon or something that would show up.
Is that whether or not you open the email?
When it arrives. So virus, you might open it, it's got an attachment, you open the attachment, and you got a virus through the file. So the file moved on the email, and the virus moved on the file. So here what's happening is the worm sends an email to another computer, and it installs a program on that computer, and what that program does is install the worm on the computer, and send the file on to the next computer. So worms, unlike viruses, are self-propagating. The viruses are harmful on machines that are not connected to the network, and therefore we saw viruses much earlier. Once everybody was networked, if I want to take down the network, all I do is I create a worm that I send out to a bunch of people who get the worm. The worm installs itself on their computer. It sends itself out to a bunch of other computers. Eventually, it fills the mail storage of every computer it reaches, which, since it's a lot of computers sending to a lot of computers, is eventually every computer. So this was actually done. There was a fellow whose father was fairly high up in the National Security Agency, but he didn't have really good judgment. And he learned how to make a worm, and then he went out and did it. And of course, the National Security Agency is in charge of keeping people from doing this. So in any case, it created a little bit of family trouble. But he went to jail because it shut down. For quite a while. Okay, enough of ownership. This is now identity. You've seen the cartoon before? On the internet, nobody knows you're a dog, and of course, nobody is a dog. Okay, so the question is, can you be a dog if you're not? So, of course, we want to do this so that you can control access. And we'd like to have, for example, attribution. But we don't always want attribution. Can you give me some examples of when we wouldn't want attribution? Okay.
If you're a spammer.
If you're a spammer. Good. Others?
You're buying something online, you know,
You don't want it to be known that you bought this product because you might be buying a product that carries some sort of stigma. You might be buying an AIDS medication or something. You might not want your insurance rates to go up or have your insurance canceled.
Or even for less nefarious purposes, trying to get a birthday gift and trying to hide the fact that you're getting that birthday gift.
Okay. You might be a whistleblower. Mm-hmm. You might simply be wishing to send your professor a helpful comment about how he could improve his teaching without necessarily having it be attributed to you. So, one semester, I actually taught this earlier in the semester, and I taught the students how to fill a Gmail. At which point, the next week, I got all sorts of comments, suggestions for how I could improve my teaching, which were anonymous, and I thought, actually, they were sort of defeating the purpose because they were demonstrating to me how well they understood what I had been teaching and how, in fact, my teaching had been effective. Right? So, providing anonymous commentary has benefits. So, forgery is remarkably easy with email, by the way, if you wish to send me such comments. What you do is you go to your Microsoft Outlook client or whatever. You simply change your email address to any other email address you wish, your name to any other name, and send the email. And as long as the server to which you're connecting doesn't have any way of authenticating you, right, like if you're using Comcast or something like that, it'll allow you to have any return address. If you don't like that, you just set up a Gmail account, just an anonymous Gmail account. Right? You know, you just make up the anonymous 4262 at gmail.com. A message. And so, in one case, you actually impersonate me. In fact, I did get several emails from me, because of how I got through my and in other cases, all you can do is achieve anonymity, but not impersonation. Okay. So anyway, this is a serious problem because the internet was developed by a bunch of people who were interested in the technology and who had a social network of trust, and so they didn't need technical means of ensuring that identity was established. So what we need is we need some way of authenticating identity. And if you think about it, this gets really complex pretty fast. So the first thing is, I need a way to tell my machine who I am. So, one example of how to do that is in my laptop. That's a fingerprint reader. And so, when I turn on my laptop, it won't give you access until you swipe your fingerprint. Now, as soon as your fingerprint reader fails, it will give you access even after you swipe your fingerprint. So, not many people use the fingerprint reader because it reduces the problem of destroying your laptop to the problem of destroying your fingerprint reader. But that sort of technology is one kind of identity protection. You have to train the thing, of course, so my laptop and then program it, so I couldn't. You could. So that's an example of a physical protection. You can also have electronic protection. The most common of these is passwords. So if I wanted to make up a good password, well, let's not do that. If I wanted to make up a bad password, a really bad password, one that was very easy to guess, what would be a really bad password? That would be really bad. Yeah. Or no password, that would be even worse, right? So, how about a one-character password? A or Q or something. Why would that be bad?
All
I got
to do is push
it
in
here.
26
choices.
26 tries and we're done, right? How about a two-character password? 26 squared. Would that be enough? Why? That takes me a long time to type in all of that.
Your programs do that.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, so how many characters would I need in my password before a computer couldn't catch it?
Zero.
and all the time that exists between now and the time I die. I would point out probably wouldn't care.
There's not. I mean, anything can be...
Anything can be guessed.
Anything can be guessed. It's all dependent upon the skill and the patience of the perpetrator.
Well, no, I will claim that it's dependent upon three things. The skills, the patience, and the luck of the perpetrator. Because anything could be guessed on the first try.
I could just
guess right. Yes?
That's a really important point. There is no secure password. Because I could guess it. And I might be right. There is simply a password that you are unlikely to guess, or really unlikely to guess, or really, 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 really unlikely to guess. So I can drive the probability as low as I want, but not to zero. That's not just true of passwords. That's true of everything. Everything that I try to protect with a password, you could guess the password. But the password is used as the basis for encryption. That's not called a password, it's called a key. But the problem of decrypting something is reducible to the problem of guessing the key, because the person who receives it can decrypt it, he is an authorized recipient. So I can always guess right sometimes. And so there is no such thing as perfect protection. The only thing we could ever hope to do is make it very unlikely. So, let's say that I wish to make it very unlikely, which is, let's say, less than a 1 in a million chance of you getting the password right anytime while I'm still alive, if you have a computer issuing guesses as fast as you can. There must be some number of characters that would be so many you couldn't possibly guess it in my lifetime. Yeah. So 6 is a really good number, right? If you can get a password 6 characters long, it becomes very expensive for them to guess every possible combination. 8 is even better. Right? So I can guess up to 4 or 5 pretty easily. You do the math. Figure out, you know, remember all those microseconds? He has a really good time. If you could guess so many passwords per second, how many seconds would it take to do that? This would be cool. How many characters should be in your password? Good. Okay. Okay. But anyway, you got the basic idea, right? Okay, now, the only problem is, most of those combinations of characters don't occur in nature. There aren't any words with any particular 6 combinations, right? So if I really wanted to guess your password, why would I try, if I knew your password was, let's say, 8 characters long, why would I try all of the 8 character combinations? That would take me a long time. I could just try all the 8 letter words in the English dictionary. And I guess your password is going to be a word, otherwise how would you remember it? So, what's that?
That's why you add numbers and characters to it.
So you're telling me that if I use 8 letter words, or all the words up to 8 letters, or all the words up to 10 letters, or something like that, that's really not a whole lot of words. But if I just put a number after it, it'll make things so much better. I mean, there are only 10 numbers. So I'll just have 10 times as many things to check. It'll take me 10 minutes instead of 1 minute.
It's added.
Okay, it doesn't have to be added at the end. It could be added in any position, and it could be any number of digits. Right? And if upper and lowercase are different, then it's not 26, it's 52 things that I have to work on. Right? So, this is why you do letters, numbers, uppercase, lowercase, long. But, if you do it with gibberish, there's a big fad a few years ago where they would issue you a password and you couldn't change it. That was a gibberish password. So everybody wrote them down. Well, I mean, that was just exactly a wrong incentive, right? Because then all you had to do was lose the list. Something like my father's got this list of 20 passwords right next to his computer. All I have to do is break into his house. I've got all the passwords. So that's what the people trying to steal the passwords will do. They'll break into the house, they'll steal the computer and the passwords. Right? Okay. So
better if you can remember your passwords. But if you use the password and remember it, you're going to have another password for some other thing. You're going to have to remember that, but not only do you have to remember both passwords, you have to remember which password to use for which. So you'll make your life so much easier. You'll come up with these really good passwords, and then you'll just use them for everything. Right? So now when I want your password, what do? Create some cool new service, and I say, tell me your user ID, tell me your password. You do. You tell me your user ID, tell me the password you always use. I say, thank you very much. I give you the benefit of the really cool free service. And meantime, I go take all the money out of your bank account. Because you just, I ask you for your user ID and your password, and you gave it to me. Right? So what do we do now? So I have to have a password that is memorable, which means it can't be too hard to guess because I have to remember it. Right? So I've got to have a password that's memorable, and I have to have a password that is that's different for everything I do. But now, everything I do, I can't remember which password to go with. So what do I do?
What's that?
That's what? Well,
you remember it, and you have the remember me option, so when you go to the site, it's already in there for you, and you can put
it in. Right. So I teach my computer my passwords, which removes the problem of cracking my password, and reduces it to the problem of getting the passwords out of the computer.
But someone uses your computer, then they have
to steal your computer. If they steal it, but they don't have to steal the computer. You remember the security patches that are getting installed every week? That's what they're protecting. The ability to break into your computer and pull off the passwords. Okay, so this is not really a very good idea to store the computer, the passwords on the computer. I mean, it's better than forgetting the passwords, but it's kind of a hack. So what you really want to do is you want to get one password that you register with somebody you trust, and that somebody you trust authenticates you to whichever services you want to be authenticated to, because you establish a trust relationship with your bank or something, some place you trust, and then they establish a relationship with the different services. So Microsoft created this, for example, with Microsoft's Passport, except that you don't trust Microsoft. That was a bad idea. But the idea was that everybody would need this centralized authentication structure. There'd be a market for it. And the answer is there probably is a market for it. But probably not with Microsoft running. Well, I don't think kind of like that. So, you'd have to think about who it is that this belongs to. Or you can get password management on your computer that stores the passwords in encrypted form and asks you for a password, one password, every time you want the password for the service, and then it just remembers which ones go with which, but it has to decrypt your password every time. So it's only stored encrypted, and you remember the password, the wrong password. So you can do this locally, or you can do this with something else.
I'm just wondering, is this the same kind of thing, does OpenID kind of work the same way?
I don't know OpenID.
OpenID, it's a service kind of like the Microsoft you described, which allows you to log on to multiple sites.
Yeah. Okay.
That's describing an ID.
Okay. So that's the idea. The trouble is getting that site to be trusted. Right. So if we can get somebody I trust to run this. Okay. And so here's one of the key lessons in the entire evening. The trust infrastructure exists outside the network. It's a social construction. Why do you trust your credit card company with as much information as you give to them? It's a trust infrastructure that authenticates you to them. You give them your social security number. You give them how much money you made. You give them information you wouldn't give anybody else. And they protect it pretty well. You have problems selling the information to people you might not want to have it, but in general, they think very carefully about it, much more carefully than computer geeks have thought about these things.
Right? So, actually, when people do this, you need to have this central trusted authority for a whole lot of different things. And so people deal with the trust infrastructure, and the place they usually start is with credit cards. For example, if we want to verify that you're an adult, so that you can sign up to see adult content, then one of the ways of doing this is to get your credit card. Because the credit card spending companies spend a lot of effort to make sure that the birth record matches the claimed age. Okay, then changing your password often is intended to guard against password sniffers and things like that, which if you use encrypted transmission becomes less of a problem. But the university first forced us all to use encrypted transmission, and then they made us change our passwords all. So it used to be you could go a long time without changing your passwords, but now we change it all. And this causes you to forget your password, which then causes you to make your password very obvious, and always one number higher than your previous password. Which causes them to check to see if your password is one number higher than your previous password, and to complain, which causes you to make it two numbers higher than your previous password, which causes them to check for that, and eventually, have you ever had one of these situations where there is no good password, every time you pick a password, it comes back and tells you that your password is not really up to snuff, and better passwords exist, and you just have to get with the program? Okay. All right. Okay, so that's good message. If nothing else, you'll at least know that just like not keeping your virus checker up to date, it's your fault when your bank account gets leaked out because you didn't keep your password long. So, we talked about brute force, right? I'll try A, then I'll try B, then I'll try C, then I'll try AAA, or I'll try everything in the dictionary. We talked about guessing. So, you ever see Sneaker movie where they get some whiz kid in to crack the PIN number on the bank card and like, birthday, birthday, birthday. Wife's birthday. Mother's birthday. Mother. So, the guessing business is really much easier than it seems like it should be. Theft is the one we talked about, you break out of the house, get a little password. Phishing is, everybody know what phishing is? So phishing is when I pretend to be some service that you should give your password to. So the common one, the one that made phishing famous, was the Nigerians. So it turned out there was this guy in Nigeria who was very wealthy and he passed away. And his wife wanted to transfer a lot of money to the United States, but couldn't because of currency. But if you would send her your bank account number, she would transfer it to you as long as you would transfer 80% of it to the appropriate account. Right, and you would make 20% of $30 million or whatever it was, which, you know, looks like a good deal, even if it's a small chance of being true. Why not find out? So you send your bank account number to these people, and the routing transfer number and all that stuff, which they would then use to take all the money out of your account. So perhaps they did one day send, you know, die and have $30 million because they'd taken all this money out of people's accounts. What people try to do is they try to figure out what kind of services you're most likely to have a commercial relationship with, and then they create a message from that kind of service that they send to you to see if you'll send them your account numbers and passwords and things like that, things that they can make use of. Right? So you'll often get this. I get these funny things that say, "Dear Board." The umd.edu support team has determined that your account has been compromised. Would you please send us your user ID and password and birthday so that we can confirm your correct account? Thank you, the umd.edu support team. And I'm like,
These clearly are people that have not taken 690 that are sending this, because you could really make so much better of a fraud than that. So in any case, they're getting better, but very slowly. And putting those tracks on the internet probably is a bad idea. Watch it. I think that's some ideas. Okay, so one of the ways of doing access control is to get the good password. But then you have the bigger problem that somebody's dishing out the passwords. Somebody's actually running the system. And so you need to protect that account even better, as we talked about already. The other problem is people coming in and taking advantage of the broken operating system, the flaws that haven't yet been detected. And so the way in which this is handled now is that usually they're doing something truly bizarre with the way the network interface works. You know, they send messages that are longer than a normal length packet, and the extra parts get written to some part of memory that happens in a certain brand of operating system to get stored in a certain place in memory, and then 4 minutes later to get randomly executed or something. Right? So that's the sort of thing they're taking advantage of. Overwriting buffers is very common. So what you do is you build a device that sits here and it looks at every packet on the internet and says, this one look normal? Okay, let it through. This one look normal? Nope. Block it. This one look normal? Let it through. Alright? Anybody watch the movie at the beginning of the semester and these packets come along and the machine comes down and crashes it? Nobody watched it? Oh, there's a great movie. You should go home and watch it. I mean, it's really cool. And it does the firewall thing very well. The problem is that, so there's this big hammer that comes down and smashes a packet, and the packet doesn't fit the definition, according to the movie. So, you can imagine as packets going along, what gets hammered? Everything that doesn't look normal. What doesn't look normal? Everything that's new. So you land up, they buy firewalls to make sure that the only things that get through look okay, and then you come up with something that doesn't look okay because they've never seen it before. It's perfectly fine. They've just never seen it before. So an example of this is you show up at a hotel and you want to connect to your company through a virtual private network. Well, the virtual private network looks pretty darn nefarious. Because it encrypts everything, right? And so they sit here looking and they go, hey, encrypted cell phone box. Hey, encrypted cell phone box. And so you can't connect with VPNs. So there are actually hotels now that advertise that their firewall will allow VPN connections. And there are companies that keep track of which companies allow it, and their people stay at those hotels. Okay, so firewalls are built to enforce access control. And they have this sort of tail chase with the development of new technology. And so sometimes I'll go to a place and I'll want to give a demo, like of that search system I was showing you, and they'll have to open a port in the firewall so that that particular port on that computer can be accessed at that time, you know, with anything. So I got a bunch of weird stuff going back and forth. And as soon as I leave, they'll turn off that port. So people that have very good network security have people sitting there actually manipulating the firewall, opening and closing it for specific purposes. Okay. So, shall we take a break? And in the meantime, you can...
Oh, yeah.
So, do you have a right to privacy?
Yes.
Yes. Right comes from. Oh, Yanni had an answer.
Oh, Mao is Ben and Jerry's.
Yay!
And the nearest Ben and Jerry's is?
Seems like an actually important fact.
It's not helpful if we don't know where it is.
There's one in Silver.
There's one in Silver.
Yeah.
The next night is, or the next day rather, is 31-6, good night, Cash and Robin, just that sort of thing.
It is, one of those is called Crush.
It's also free iced coffee day.
Okay. I'm glad we got that done. Fortunately, last class we finished 20 minutes early, so I won't feel at all bad about going 20 minutes late to make up for the time that we have. Okay. So you have right to privacy, and it's derived from the U.S. Constitution, where it isn't actually stated. But in any case, it seems to be inferred, unless you're a strict construction. Well, anyway, we believe we have a right to privacy until we decide we don't. Now, if I'm in New York City, standing in the middle of the street, do I have a right to privacy? No. Do I have a right to anonymity? So, for example, can someone say, that person over there, that's the ex-con?
If it's true,
they can say. So I don't have a right to anonymity. People can say things about me that I wish be kept private.
Especially
if I'm a celebrity. Okay.
Police officer comes up to you and asks to see your ID. Not going to remain anonymous for very long.
Okay, so I don't have a right to anonymity in a public place, and I surely don't have a right to privacy in a public place. It's not a public place, right? How about the internet? Is the internet a public place? Do I have then a right to privacy on the internet? Really? Even if I do things at home, surely at work, my employer has some rights in the U.S. to look at things that they wouldn't in other countries have a right to look at, but they do in the U.S. But if I'm at home, the government can see what I do. It's a subpoena, but otherwise I'm protected against unreasonable search and seizure, right? How about my internet service provider? Can they sell my activity? So if I let them, if I haven't signed a license agreement with them or something like that. Okay, so I've signed my license agreement. Thank you. Okay, so now, sooner or later, it becomes a problem. If I wish to keep my my communications private, then one thing that I can do is I can encrypt my communications on my computer. I can walk over to you, give you the same key that I use to encrypt it. You can use that key to decrypt it. This is a Buck Rogers decoder ring. Right? I sent my Buck Rogers decoder ring. You set your Buck Rogers decoder ring the same way. And you can see the secret text, but anybody who's watching sees only nonsense. Right? So this has a little bit of a problem. Anybody see what the problems are? What's that? What happens if I get the key? But I gave Bob the key.
Right, but someone other than Bob gives it.
Then they have access to. Okay. What else? Why is it bad to have only one key? Bob can pretend to be me, right? Bob, yeah, I can encrypt it. Bob can decrypt it. Bob can encrypt it. Pretend to be me, I can decrypt it. There's no role here. There's a roleless encryption, right? So everybody's got the same key. What I'd really like to have, and this would be cool if we could think of a way to do it, is Alice has the key that she could use to encrypt it, Bob has the key to decrypt it, and Alice can't decrypt it, and Bob can't encrypt it. We have different keys. Now that doesn't make any sense, but if we could come up with a way of doing that, that would be really cool. So, here's how it's done. Alice has an encryption key, Bob has a decryption key, and the keys are different. How's that done? Well, if I give you a number, and I ask you to tell me which numbers got multiplied together to create this number, if you can get that from the number, then you can break this code. So for example, let's say I gave you 4. And I asked you which prime numbers got multiplied together to get 4. 2 and 2, okay? So let's say I gave you 121.
11,
okay? So we can do this, you know, for a lot of time, right? It turns out that the problem gets harder as the numbers get longer. And by the time the numbers get to 128 bits, it's getting really hard. And by the time they get to 1,000 bits, nobody will ever be able to do it. The fastest algorithms for factoring into prime numbers, 1,024-bit numbers, are hopelessly slow. I mean, they'll take more than your entire lifetime to run. On the fastest computers that exist. On banks of the fastest computers that exist. So, what do? We use that fundamental idea to create two sets of encryption, or two sets of keys, one to encrypt with, and the other to decrypt. And now look what I can do. I can say, I'm Doug. Here's my public key. And then I encrypt everything I say. And everybody in the world can decrypt it. But they have to use my public key. Otherwise, it's nonsense. Thereby, I prove in everything I say, I'm Doug. Because only Doug could have encrypted this. Only the person that, what's that? Okay, Bob. Or Adam, only Alice in this case. Could have encrypted it. Not Alice. Okay? This is a digital signature. This is how you implement digital signatures. That's what I want to do. I want to prove that only I could have authored this. How do I do it? I create a public key, and I give it away. And then I encrypt things with my private key. You use the public key to decrypt it. If it decrypts, okay, I'm done. Well, actually, I'm not Doug. I'm the person that claimed to be Doug when I gave away the key. Right? See the problem? How do I get around this problem? I just changed the problem of getting you a certification that's me to the problem of getting you my public key. Right? So how do I get you my public key in a way that you'll believe it came from me? We've already talked about this. The credit card, right? I use a trust infrastructure that exists. This is not a technical problem. This is a social problem, right? So what I do is I create a certificate authority in which Bob registers his public key, and from which Alice can get Bob's public key. Alice can encrypt something that only Bob can read. So this is the other way of using the infrastructure. So Bob here, Bob wants to allow people to send him secret messages. So now anybody can encrypt a message and send it to Bob, but only Bob can read it. So Bob doesn't have to protect the key. Bob can give the key away to everybody. Say, hey, look, if you want to send me a secret message, use this key. Nobody can decrypt it with the same key. You have to have the private key to decrypt it. Right? So you can do this either way. I can send you a secret message that only you can decode, or I can send you a message that only I could have written and that everybody can decode. Because the public key and the private key are interchangeable. Clear how this works?
Yes?
No, it's not. I just don't get it.
Okay, so.
Sorry.
There are two issues. One is, what's the geeky stuff that makes this work? And the other is, if I could make a system that worked this way, where with one key I encrypt, and the other key you decrypt. But the key that encrypts cannot decrypt. You have to get the other key. Then I can keep my key secret. I give away the public key, keep the private key secret. You send to me something. I decrypt it. Nobody else can see it but me. You can address it directly to me. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I want to sign a letter. I take my name, encrypt it, using my private key. Anybody can decrypt it with the public key. You can communicate to me privately. I can communicate to you in a way that could have only come from me. With me?
Mm-hmm.
But that only works if you believe my public key really is my public key. Well, he's substituted by my brother for his public key because he wants to pretend to be me. Yes? So I have to have some way of getting you my public key. My public key, I never give you my private key. Yes? So now I need a trust infrastructure to do that. So some trusted third party I can hand it to, somebody I trust, who you also trust. So I hand it to them and they give it to you. With me so far?
Yeah.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Answer the question, or?
Well, and who is this? I don't get who this authority is and why we would both necessarily trust it.
Oh, I don't know. So the question is, can we come up with an authority that we would both trust? And the answer is, we have to construct one. It's a social construct,
okay.
And this whole thing fails if we don't have one. So what we do is we take some existing trust infrastructure, like credit cards,
okay.
And we use it as a basis for establishing another trust infrastructure.
Got it.
I get called by very long today. I get this message that says they get it expired.
Yes.
Okay or no.
Yes.
And we tell us it's like okay.
Yes.
Because I didn't get the data.
Yes.
But that means that this organization used to be a part of this specific authority and now, like, they've
didn't pay their dues or something. Yes. Yeah. So what happens is, I don't want somebody to be able to sniff my password, right? So what I do is I pass my public key to you when you connect to me, and then everything you send to me, you encrypt, and everything I send to you, I encrypt. And you can decrypt it with my public key, and I keep my private key. You see how this works? I wanted to connect to you, and so in order to connect to you, I had to set up a way of passing you my public key. And because my public key is public, I can send it to you. It's not a secret. I don't need an encrypted link. So I send it to you. You know that it's coming from me because you just connected to me on the network. So you have to protect against a man with a little attack, where somebody on the network pretends to be me, right, and issues a public key on my behalf. But if you can protect against that, then you can set up this channel so that nobody in the middle to monitor, even though they saw the public key go by, because they don't hold the private key. And that's what Secure Sale does, SSH. That's what FFTP does, the secure version of FTP, built on top of SSH. And it's what HTTPS does, the secure version of HTTP. Right? So if you go to use a financial institution website, it will set up a secure connection so that when you're transferring your financial data, it will be protected in transit. Your passwords will be protected in transit. And you get a little lock icon that shows up on your web browser, a little key icon, and you get HTTPS in the URL. But the problem is that I could, if I control the network, intercept your public key and replace it with my public key and thus become your financial institution. As you make a web page, it looks like your financial institution. Even though you connected to the financial institution, because I'm inside the network,
I can intercept that. A man, it's called a man in the middle attack. With me? If I want to protect against the man in the middle attack, which I really would like to do for financial institutions, then I have to have a certificate authority. And I pass the public key through a certificate authority. So HTTPS does not have a certificate authority for the raw connection. SFTP, SSH, don't have certificate authorities. But I can configure my system to work with a certificate authority. In which case, the certificate authority has to have a trust relationship with me. And you have to have a trust relationship with the certificate authority. Now the problem is, you probably don't have a trust relationship with the certificate authority. So you get these questions. Is this a trusted? Do you trust software for this sort of message? So the problem has to exist on both ends. They don't pay their dues, they're out. You don't establish the relationship in the first place, you're out, and you probably don't have the relationship established. So most of your customers don't have this. And so we're still vulnerable to the man in the middle attack. We're in the process of building this trust infrastructure. Okay? Okay. So you can see, there's the public key. Oh, and the university has one of these certificates for the university. If you say once, I trust that it's coming from the university, and you bought the university certificate for anybody they lend or previously, you accept it. And you probably trust the university, at least for the university. The problem is you can't just trust the university. It's the university. You now trust the university for everything. Okay. So, last point. One of the things archivists care a lot about is whether the bits I store are the same bits when I take them back out. They want to give you an assurance of integrity of the file. Why? Well, just imagine that I have an email that says, hi Mom, I got caught stealing money from the company and they fired me today. And imagine that's in the company's server. So maybe it says I got caught stealing $50 from the company and they fired me. And you go to court and they produce an email that says, hi Mom, I got caught stealing $50,000 from the company today and they fired me. Well, how easy would it be to forge that email? You just put a comma in and three more zeros, right? Because there's nothing in email that gives you any kind of integrity to the content. And yet, people use email as evidence of, I don't know, look at what's going on in Boston, or not in Boston, in Detroit, the mayor, right? SMS messages going back and forth. Those things have no integrity at all, assured to them. Just a bunch of characters, somebody can put in different characters if they feel like and tell a different story. So archivists care a lot about getting you data that has the exact same bits that went in or the bits that are going to come out because they're interested in evidence of human activity. That's what they're trying to fundamentally preserve. So how would you get the evidence of human activity into the future in a way that preserved the integrity of the file? Well, communication through space is quite the same thing as communication through time. I simply encrypt it before I store it, and then somehow, through some sort of a trust infrastructure, move the key forward into the future. So I encrypt it with my private key. I encrypt everything. And I keep the private key private until it's all encrypted. And then I can throw away the private key, thus making it impossible for anyone else to create inauthentically anything else in this set. Then I move the data forward into the future with the public key sitting right next to it. if somebody takes away the data, okay, it's gone. I have to make sure that doesn't happen. If somebody takes away the public key, it's gone. You can't ever see the data again. But if I take the public key and I send it to everybody on the planet, it's probably not going to be gone. Probably the public key will get into the future. So I can get the public key into the future, and I can get the encrypted data into the future. And then I take the encrypted data, and I can decrypt it, and if it decrypts with this public key, it's what was encrypted with the private key in the past. So I have to create a trust infrastructure on the private key and the public key, and move those into the future. And so archivists love encryption, because encryption takes the problem of preserving integrity, and it reduces it to the problem of preserving integrity on the key. And archivists hate encryption, because it reduces the problem of losing the data to the problem of losing the key. So archivists have this love-hate relationship with encryption. You tell the archivists about how you're going to make their life so much better using encryption, and they're like,
"Well, no, this is really bad. Let me tell you the story of when we lost the key and everything was gone," right?
So archivists have these horror stories of what happens when the key gets lost. But the way we produce a certification of authenticity in the future is exactly the same infrastructure that denies us access to information. That's the encryption process. This is what archivists are in the process of grappling with. Okay, enough fun for one night? More fun than last week? Any positive votes? Not more fun than last week. Darker than that. Well, somebody was saying this was really cool stuff and that they wanted to do this for the rest of their career here. So there are several courses on this. There are courses on legal issues and information management. There are courses on information policy generally, like what should the policy be, how are the rights balanced. And there is a really, really, really cool course, just the most fun course you have ever imagined, on how our society shapes the technologies that get built and how the technologies that get built shape our society. It's OBSC 708T. And I got to teach it 2 years ago, but it was so much fun that they're never going to do it again. And so again, pleasure to teach you all. See you next week.
I'm going to go to the next one.